And we move to the final case this morning, United States v. Carter. Ms. Aubrey?
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Mr. Koenig. My name's Ann Aubrey, and I'm here on behalf of Michael Carter, the defendant appellant in this case. Mr. Carter is currently serving a 24-month prison term following the revocation of his supervised release in this case. Back on June 4th of last year, Mr. Carter appeared before a district court in the Eastern District of Wisconsin at a hearing to address whether his supervised release should be revoked, and if so, what punishment should be imposed. At that hearing, Mr. Carter did not contest that he had committed the alleged violations that were serving as the basis for the probation officer's request for the revocation of his supervised release. He acknowledged that he had committed those offenses. So at that point, it was primarily the issue to be dealt with at that point was what would be the appropriate punishment if the court determined that revocation was appropriate. Prior to the hearing, Mr. Carter's federal probation officer, who had supervised him throughout the course of his supervised release, had prepared a report outlining Mr. Carter's compliance or noncompliance on supervised release and outlining the violations that served as the basis for the request. Following his calculation of Mr. Carter's violations, the probation officer determined that the appropriate guideline range would be 6 to 12 months. In that same report, in a section which allowed the probation officer the opportunity to propose aggravating circumstances that might support sentencing Mr. Carter outside or above the recommended guideline range, he did not do so. Likewise, at the hearing on June 4th of last year, the government advocated to the court a sentence at the high end of the recommended 6 to 12-month guideline range and did not argue for anything above that amount of time. Nonetheless, the court ultimately concluded that a 24-month sentence would be reasonable and imposed the maximum amount possible available under the statute.
I think those may be the operative words here, Ms. Aubrey. Here's my problem. The transcript reveals that the court was aware of and considered the proper factors: the nature of the offense, the history and character of the defendant, the need to protect the community, the need for consistency in sentencing. And given that what you have here is a second violation of supervised release, and given the fact that you have a court considering the appropriate factors, how do we get to a point where we say this was plainly unreasonable, even if we think this was harsh?
And, Your Honor, we understand that the standard of review here is plainly unreasonable versus abuse of discretion, which is a higher standard, though I, for the life of me, would have a difficult time delineating the two if I had to. But we do understand that. And I would proffer that there are several reasons or factors that this court can look at in reviewing the sentence imposed by the district court to determine whether or not, and in fact, perhaps find that the sentence imposed here was plainly unreasonable. Mr. Carter did walk into court and fully accept and acknowledge responsibility for what he did, the violations that he committed. And we know that at sentencings before federal district courts all over the country, defendants are given credit for accepting or acknowledging responsibility for what they have done. In this case, despite that, Mr. Carter was sentenced to the maximum allowed clearly whether he acknowledged...
Did he accept responsibility for what he had done the first time when he pled guilty?
Well, he certainly did the first time around, and he was accepting responsibility this time when before the court for the court to determine whether he should be revoked and based on whether, or, and if so, what would be the appropriate punishment in light of the breach of trust that occurred that created the basis for the revocation. So if he's accepting responsibility not only for the underlying crime, which clearly he did, and he was given credit for that, but he's also accepting responsibility for the breach of trust that he committed that resulted in his supervised release being revoked. So I do believe that there are two levels of acceptance of responsibility there, the one in the first instance and the one in the second when he was appearing in front of the court this last time. The court did refer to the seriousness of the offense that Mr. Carter committed. However, as was calculated for purposes of determining the recommended guideline range for sentencing Mr. Carter, the probation officer referred to, based on the guidelines, the various grades of violations per seriousness, with grade A being at the high end and grade C being at the low end of the continuum. And it's undisputed in this case that Mr. Carter's offenses fell in grade C and grade B, so not at the high end, but at the low and the middle end of the continuum. Nonetheless, the court sentenced him at the very highest possible end of the continuum it could, in that it imposed the maximum sentence allowed. So it was sentencing Mr. Carter as if Mr. Carter had committed the most serious offenses that would bring him before the court for revocation and possible punishment. The court, or while it's understood that the entire Chapter 7 of the guidelines is merely a recommendation and policy statement and not binding on the court, there are application notes that the Sentencing Commission has provided to courts to guide them in determining whether a sentence outside the recommended range would be appropriate. Those are found in the application notes of 7B1.4 of the United States Sentencing Guidelines. I'm not going to go through each one of those, but as I noted in my brief, none of those situations apply here. And while I understand they're not exhaustive, they certainly serve as a guidepost for a court to look at the type of scenarios that might be an appropriate one for sentencing outside and upward of the guideline range. I see that the light has gone on.
For your rebuttal, you can cut into your rebuttal or you can continue either way.
I'll save it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Koenig?
Good morning. My name is Jonathan Koenig. I appear on behalf of the United States to argue that the revocation sentence in this case was not plainly unreasonable. Sections 3583 and 3553 of Title 18 direct the sentencing judge to consider the history and characteristics of the defendant. What was the most salient characteristic of this particular defendant? I would say his status as a more or less incorrigible grifter. By the time he appeared before Judge Randa in 2004, he had already admitted to or been convicted of several scams involving false names, fake social security numbers, stolen credit cards. And the most recent of these scams, of course, had occurred while he was on supervised release in violation of the terms thereof. In fact, in the criminal judgment, as in most judgments in our district, I think the first or second condition is always, thou shalt not commit another federal or state crime. So it was entirely appropriate for Judge Randa to consider the defendant's recent criminal activity, the nature of that activity, and its similarity to the previous offenses, both the underlying offense and the conduct that led to the first revocation of supervised release. This clearly bespoke a pattern, as Judge Randa mentioned on the transcript. Now, the fact that Judge Randa laid emphasis on this particular factor, the nature of the recent conduct, does not mean that he sentenced Mr. Carter for that conduct. That's a claim that's made in my opponent's brief. It's pretty clear when you read the transcript in its entirety, there are several references by Judge Randa to the separate proceeding that had yet to occur before Judge Clavert. So I think it's clear that Judge Randa was not sentencing the defendant for this recent criminal conduct, but merely taking it into consideration, along with, I should add, other supervised release violations. And this was a footnote point in my brief, and perhaps it should not have been, because it's important. There was a failure to make restitution, a failure to meet child support obligations, and I believe also a failure on the part of the defendant to file a tax return for the year 2003.
Why do you think it shouldn't have been a footnote? Why do you think it shouldn't have been a footnote? Do you think that we don't read footnotes?
We have an ongoing debate about that in our office, and some people are very anti-footnote.
This is the first time I've learned it.
And others are not. In any event, I think it's significant that there was more than just the recent crime on Mr. Carter's part.
What did the government recommend in this case?
The government recommended the high end of the advisory guideline range.
That was 6 to 12 months, wasn't it?
Yes. And as defense counsel acknowledges, of course, that range is advisory because it is in a non-interpretive policy statement within the guidelines.
Is there anything in the law that applies to sentencing after revocation of supervised release that requires the maximum penalty to be reserved for the most serious form of the offense, or can it be assessed against someone who has repeatedly violated supervised release?
I'm not aware of any provision of that kind.
Or anything in the case law that would require that approach? Or was Judge Randa free to impose the maximum based on the fact that he had a repeat customer, essentially?
I think the plainly unreasonable standard itself allows for the sentencing judge, and in this case a judge who had seen Mr. Carter before, to make exactly that kind of assessment, to consider the nature of the offense, you know, things that aren't necessarily spelled out anywhere in the statute or the guidelines.
So even though the nature of the offense comes in at somewhere below the most severe form of the offense, the maximum re-imprisonment term can be imposed in the discretion of the judge if the post-sentencing circumstances warrant it?
Yes. Okay. I mean, I think obviously this is a very fact-specific question, but again, I think the standard of review is capacious enough to permit the sentencing judge to consider factors that may not necessarily be set forth in the statute or in the guidelines.
Will the record tell us here anywhere whether Judge Clavert sentenced concurrently or consecutively?
I believe, Your Honor, and counsel will correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a 21-month sentence and that it was consecutive to the revocation sentence. Of course, that had not occurred at the time.
Right, that's why I...
Right. Given the history and characteristics of this defendant, which were well known to this judge, it was not plainly unreasonable to impose a 24-month sentence, and we would ask you to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Cohen. Ms. Aubrey? You have 3 minutes.
To begin with, I do concur with my colleague. In fact, the sentencing judge in the other case, Judge Clavert, did impose a 20-month consecutive sentence to the one imposed by Judge Randa. What I would ask this court to do is to look at the record and what the factors were upon which this district judge used to impose the maximum sentence allowed. He mentioned in his comments at sentencing that he was relying upon the government's recommendation for a sentence at the high end of the guideline range. However, the government did not recommend anything higher than 12 months. So I don't know how much of a factor that can truly be in determining whether or not that was reasonable. I would also ask the court to look at whether or not this judge articulated a reason for the specific sentence that he was going to impose above the guideline range. And what I mean by that is he did say at one point during the sentencing argument or the sentencing comments that he was not going to impose a mathematical formula in determining what the precise number of months would be that he would impose in this sentence. But he did not articulate any reason for why it would be something other than 12 versus 18 versus 24.
Well, how much specificity should we require of a district court in imposing a higher sentence? Is it enough if the court explicitly considers some of the appropriate factors? What's your view?
Well, my view is that if a court is going to sentence someone above either a mandated or recommended guideline range, that court should provide some explanation for the specific sentence that it's imposing. For instance, I am going to double this sentence because I think this particular conduct fits within this type of guideline recommendation. So as one would do in a mandatory guideline situation, if the court is going to depart upward, the court has to explain why the specific...
Aren't we back right into the same thing of mandatory guidelines?
But once again, it's
about... Or do you want us to do the sentencing?
I want the court to be specific and articulate why twice the amount of the recommended guideline range is appropriate versus half the amount or whatever the amount was. He simply said, I won't do a mathematical formula. I'm just giving you 24 months. I don't believe that's the specificity.
Well, didn't he say that it was a pattern of serial conduct, basically, and the need to afford adequate deterrence and to protect the public and the need to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities? Because I think he said something about, this is the kind of thing I've done. This is consistent with sentences that I've given in other cases, and I'm really wondering why you don't think that's enough.
Once again, I don't believe that that simply saying this is the recommended guideline range, and this is what I'm imposing, especially when what is being imposed is the maximal allowed. He doesn't explain why twice the amount is necessary. For instance, here's 12 months, here's 24 months, this is what's appropriate. I don't know that just simply saying that your offense was serious, that you have a pattern of misbehavior is enough to justify that extent of an upward departure.
Ms. Aubrey, you have the court's thanks for taking this assignment and for arguing a very difficult position.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
The court...
Really well.
The court will be... in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30.